Have you ever come across the concept of custom beauty? I know it sounds skeptical. It's like every time you scroll online, there's a new miracle product promising to fix your hair and skin woes. But let me tell you, PROS is the real deal when it comes to custom beauty. It's not just some marketing gimmick. Your personalized formula wouldn't even exist without your input. Each product on PROS is whipped up just for you, tailored to your specific needs, and they go deep into their consultations, delving into over 80 factors to really get a handle on your life and beauty goals. We're talking about everything from your hair and skin concerns to what you eat, how much you work out, and even how stressed you are. My friend Jen has been using PROS and raving about it non-stop. They even asked her about her zip code to suss out things like water hardness and UV index. When I hit the States later this year, PROS is going to be at the top of my shopping list. But until then, I'm living vicariously through Jen's luscious locks and glowing skin. Trust me, this stuff is the real deal. PROS is so confident that you'll love your results that they're offering my listeners an exclusive trial offer so you can see the difference custom care can make. 50% off your first subscription order at PROSE.com/morbidology. That is PROSE.com/morbidology for your free consultation and 50% off your one-of-a-kind formula, PROSE.com/morbidology.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do. And start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Wairarapa is a small town in New Zealand, which shows its true beauty in spring. Daffodils are dotted throughout the area, which is backdropped by the snowy Tararua Ranges. In 2003, a little girl never showed up to class one morning, and the community truly bonded together to try and bring her home safely. Her disappearance would reveal a dark underbelly of the town, as well as highlight many systemic issues within child protection services, as well as the justice system. It was school kicking out time at South Featherston School in Featherston, North Island, New Zealand, on the 9th of September 2003. Gianna Kremen made her way to the school bus stop, where her children would depart from to walk the short distance home. Fear swept across Gianna when she couldn't find her daughter, 6-year-old Coral Burrows. Gianna made her way to the school expecting to find her daughter there, but her fear escalated even further when she was informed that Coral never arrived at school that morning. Gianna immediately called the police, and by 5:15 p.m., a search party was mobilized. According to Coral's stepfather, Stephen Williams, he had dropped Coral off at school that morning at around 8:40 a.m. There were two pupils who said that they had seen Coral that morning in the school grounds, shortly before the bell rang at 9 a.m. Coral lived at home with her mother, Gianna, her stepfather, Stephen, her 8-year-old brother, Storm, and her newborn baby brother, Luke. Gianna and Coral's father, Ron Burrows, had separated, and Ron lived in Tauranga after he signed the house over to Gianna because he wanted his children to grow up knowing where home was. Despite the separation, Ron still had a very close and very loving relationship with both of his children. Ron said that his daughter loved nothing more than cuddles. Coral was known to be very energetic, feisty, and cheeky, pretty much a typical 6-year-old child. Her best friend was Carlene Rex, and the two girls enjoyed playing with their Barbies together, as well as playing tag in the school playground. Coral also had a real tomboy side, and she loved getting down and dirty with her brother Storm and his friends. Storm would later speak with One News about what Coral was like.
Yeah, whenever we went outside to ride motorbikes or go fishing, she always wanted to come. She never wanted to be left out. Yeah, she never really dressed like a girl. It was more bloody trackies and that, and whenever we were getting muddy and that, she was there with us.
Around 40 police officers and concerned locals combed the farm and bushland in the surrounding area, as well as the 3-kilometre stretch of roadside beside South Featherston School and Featherston Township and the school's grounds. They trudged through farm properties, searching in barns and hedges, looking in drains and searching under anything which could be searched under. Locals living between the school and Featherston were asked to search buildings on their property to see if Coral could be hiding somewhere. The area between Coral's school and her home was mainly farmland, but there were a plethora of places for a little child to hide. A helicopter hovered overhead to try and catch a glimpse of Coral, but had to be called off due to bad weather. Around 50 millimetres of rain fell throughout the day, which really hampered the search, and the weather overnight was expected to be 4 degrees Celsius. Time truly was of the essence. If Coral was outside in that weather, it would have been extremely dangerous. Missing person flyers were printed and described Coral as white with shoulder-length brown hair. When she went to school that morning, she was wearing a fluorescent pink quilted jacket, red pants with one stripe down each leg, and a blue t-shirt. She was carrying a red backpack with black shoulder straps. Investigators made their way to the family's home for a search and to conduct generic interviews with her family, as well as her school friends. Sergeant Ben Offner quickly stated that there was no indication that there had been any kind of trouble at home, or a fight with any other pupil at the school. However, Coral's stepfather, Stephen, would inform investigators that Coral and her 8-year-old brother, Storm, had missed the school bus that morning, so he had to drive them to school. He said that he and Coral had a disagreement over Coral not wanting to go to school. Storm was brought in for questioning and confirmed that his little sister had been driven to school with him that morning by their stepfather.
Storm, I need you to tell me a little bit about you. I need to tell me your full name.
Storm Thomas Ross Burrows.
Storm Thomas Ross Burrows.
Mm.
Okay, and how old are you?
8.
And we're talking about your little sister Coral, yeah, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
Your sister went to school with you yesterday,
mm,
and then she's gone somewhere now, and we don't know where she is, and that's why we're having a talk.
She was missing since 8:30.
Mm. Okay. Where were you sitting?
In the front seat.
In the front seat. Where was Coral sitting?
In the back right-hand side.
And did you see her at all?
No.
Before school started or through the morning or the rest of
no,
the day?
No. She just disappeared.
The disappearance of Coral really terrified local residents in the tight-knit community, in particular parents. One local, Alec Webster, said, "To think that someone can be dropped off at school and then just disappear is horrifying." A lot of parents were also left questioning why the school hadn't alerted Gianna when Coral didn't show up that morning. Ministry of Education guidelines require schools to keep attendance records, but there are seemingly no rules about informing parents or guardians when a child does not show up. It's up to the individual school to set up their own systems, and Board of Trustees chairwoman, Sandra Walters, said that the school did have a system in place wherein if a child was absent from school without an explanation, then the parents would be contacted. She stated, "I can't comment on how it operated today." The following day, Ron arrived in Featherston and made a brief but emotional public plea for the safe return of his daughter, stating, "I just want to find my baby." Later that day, it would be revealed that on the day that Coral had disappeared, her home had been raided by police, who were completely unaware of her disappearance. Furthermore, her stepfather Stephen had been admitted to hospital, but investigators would not elaborate as to why. According to neighbours, police were spotted at the home, and as one witness said, they turned the house inside out. However, neighbours and police sources would say that the raid was in relation to drugs. Meanwhile, Coral's backpack was discovered in Abbott's Creek, which was close to her home and over 3 kilometres away from her school. Inside the backpack was Coral's uneaten lunch and her school books. The discovery led to fears that Coral had been the victim of foul play. If she had gone to school that morning, then how did her backpack end up so close to her home and so far away from the school? Detective Inspector Rod Drew said, "Finding the bag reduces the likelihood of Coral simply wandering off because of the distance involved. We can't exclude the possibility that she was taken to the Abbott's Creek area rather than getting there of her own volition." A police dive squad was called to the scene while a police helicopter hovered overhead. Investigators appealed for sightings of vehicles parked near the creek. Gianna was too overcome with emotion to participate in the search or speak publicly about the disappearance of her daughter, but Ron and other family members participated in the search. Coral's uncle, Carl Kremen, said that the family were under intense pressure, and Gianna hadn't slept at all since she found out that Coral was missing. Ron broke down as he appealed to the community for help, stating, "Maybe someone, somewhere, has heard their dog barking for no apparent reason. Just anything out of the ordinary. You may have seen a parked car somewhere. Just anything. Please help us get her back."
If the boot was on the other foot and it was me lost out there, my daughter wouldn't give up on me. Even if I'm the last person going, I'll still search for her.
Both Ron and Gianna believed that Cora was still alive. Ron said that they didn't believe that she was hiding out somewhere because she was afraid of the dark. He also said that since Coral's disappearance, her brother Storm had been sleeping in her bed, and that he wanted his little sister home as much as the rest of the family. By this point in the investigation, there were over 150 volunteers assisting in the search for Coral. Search coordinator Murray Johnson said that people had been travelling from all over to take part in this search and to help in any way possible. The Wellington Voluntary Search and Rescue Team, which is made up of tramping club members, had been called in almost as soon as Coral was reported missing. Wayne Stevens, a businessman who was a member of the search and rescue team, said that he had no hesitation when he received the phone call. He had been involved in a number of missing person cases, but said that a missing child is always the most difficult to cope with, stating, "I have a 6-year-old niece and you identify with the family. A child is such an innocent party." The community truly bonded together in a bid to bring Coral home safely. Many had to take days off work or college because they wanted to help out in any way possible. Many searched through the night and then went to their job the following morning on little sleep, and then did the same thing again the following day. For those who couldn't search, they still helped out by giving their time to make food for the searchers and to hand out missing person flyers. Ron would speak with One News about the overwhelming support.
There was companies delivering us gumboots and truckloads of meat. People just overwhelm you, you know, with their generosity and this sort of thing. I think Coral and her smile is what inspired them. She loved hugs. She used to come up and you'd say, "What do you want, Moo?" And she'd go, "Just a cuddle, Daddy." I often think she was sent here to teach me how to hug.
South Featherston School would essentially be forced to accept responsibility for not reporting Coral absent on the day she vanished. Tracy Wilson, who had been principal for a month, said that they had made a mistake. She said that roll call had been taken and Coral's absence had been noted by her teacher. However, she said that Coral's name was incorrectly put in Monday's column instead of Tuesday's column, so her absence was not followed up. She said, "It was human error that we deeply regret." She would send a newsletter to parents of pupils at school, informing them of the mistake. Counsellors from an Education Ministry Trauma Incident Team were sent to the school to speak with children and accompany them to interviews by investigators, who are planning on speaking to everybody at the school. There were only 60 pupils in the school, so it seemed best to speak to every single one. According to psychologist Sarah Chatwin, the children would be aware of the situation regarding Coral, and some could be suffering from nightmares, not eating or acting withdrawn. She said that for parents, it's impossible to keep an iron wall protecting their children, and the best thing to do was to explain the situation to your child, rather than have them hear it second-hand. The following day, it would be announced that Coral's stepfather, Stephen, had been arrested on an unrelated charge. He appeared in court on two assault charges in relation to an incident with Coral's uncle, Terry Creeman, on the 2nd of September. He was charged with assaulting Terry using a white ladder. It was noticed during his appearance that he was extremely upset and nervous. Defence lawyer Jock Blathwaite said that he would be seeking bail and questioned why the charges had even been laid, stating, "If there were any foundation for these charges, they would have been laid on September 2nd. He revealed that Stephen believed that the charges had been laid against him because they believed that he was somehow involved in Coral's disappearance, and that this was a way to keep him in custody. Following his court appearance, it would be revealed that a witness had seen a white Lada or Fiat station wagon speeding away from a lay-by near the double bridges on the morning that Coral's backpack was found in Abbott's Creek. Abbott Creek flows downstream from double bridges. It would then be revealed that two Lada station wagons, one white and one brown, had been seized and that Stephen had access to both of these cars. He said that he had taken Coral and Storm to school in a white Lada on the day that Coral disappeared. Investigators would begin compiling a list of all owners of white or cream Ladas or Fiat station wagons in the area. The following day, Gianna, Storm and Luke were moved out of the family home so that investigators could search the home. The investigation was intensified as the number of detectives working on the case was increased to 70. Ron once again made a tearful plea for the safe return of his daughter. He said he believed that Coral was still alive, but that somebody had her and was holding her against her will. At a news conference alongside Gianna, he said, "I know my daughter and I know she's a tough little girl. She's all right. She's alive." When asked if they believed that Coral was being held by somebody that they knew, they said that Coral would not have gone away with a stranger, and that stranger danger was something that had been instilled in all of their children. The forensic experts at the home would seal off a section of lawn at the back of the home after they found what they described as an unusual area. This had come shortly after two sniffer dogs that were trained to detect human remains were taken to the home. A tent was erected over the section while Detective Inspector Rod Drew said, "We haven't found Coral. There's nothing of that nature related to the area," but he refused to elaborate any further. While this search was being conducted, there was also searches being conducted on properties where Stephen had formerly worked as a farmhand. At the time of his arrest, he was unemployed. He strongly denied any involvement in the disappearance of Coral and said that he was being unfairly targeted because he had dropped her off at school that morning. While he was still behind bars, Coral's family said that they wanted him released so that they could speak to him. Carl, Coral's uncle, said that while investigators were doing an upstanding job, the family felt as though they were telling them no more than they were telling the media. It would then be announced that the search for Coral was shifting back to her school. The area surrounding the school was cordoned off while police and a sniffer dog scoured the area. Investigators announced that they now believed that Coral had been abducted and taken away from the area. They reiterated that there had been reported sightings of Coral in the school grounds on the morning that she disappeared. Have you ever come across the concept of custom beauty? I know it sounds skeptical. It's like every time you scroll online, there's a new miracle product promising to fix your hair and skin woes. But let me tell you, PROS is the real deal when it comes to custom beauty. It's not just some marketing gimmick. Your personalised formula wouldn't even exist without your input. Each product on PROS is whipped up just for you, tailored to your specific needs, and they go deep into their consultations, delving into over 80 factors to really get a handle on your life and beauty goals. We're talking about everything from your hair and skin concerns to what you eat, how much you work out, and even how stressed you are. My friend Jen has been using PROS and raving about it non-stop. They even asked her about her zip code to suss out things like water hardness and UV index. When I hit the States later this year, PROS is going to be at the top of my shopping list. But until then, I'm living vicariously through Jen's luscious locks and glowing skin. Trust me, this stuff is the real deal. PROS is so confident that you'll love your results that they're offering my listeners an exclusive trial offer so you can see the difference custom care can make. 50% off your first subscription order at PROS.com/morbidology. That is PROSE.com/morbidology for your free consultation and 50% off your one-of-a-kind formula, PROS.com/morbidology.
If you follow me on social media, you've maybe noticed that I've recently joined the app, Stereo, to offer you guys some bonus live content. Each week, I'm going to be doing live streams about true crime on the app, Stereo. Stereo is a live social conversation app where you can be a co-host, part of the conversation, or just simply listen. It's completely free to download in the App Store, and if you tune into my live streams, you can be part of it by talking with me directly during the live feed. It's completely audio-based, and you don't use your camera, so you can literally join in while you're sitting in your sweatpants in bed, and nobody would have any clue. So join me over on the Stereo app. You can check out my schedule, but I'm going to be live at least once a week. Download the Stereo app and follow me at stereo.com/morbidology. The link is in the description. That is stereo.com/morbidology. Podcorn are revolutionising podcast sponsorships and connecting unique voices to unique brands. I'm lucky enough that Podcorn have sponsored this episode of Morbidology. There was once a time when only the big popular podcasts received sponsorships, but with Podcorn, indie podcasts such as Morbidology are able to work with amazing brands. Podcorn truly takes the confusion and stress out of finding sponsorships for your podcast, or even for finding a podcast to sponsor your brand. It is a simple and straightforward way for brands and podcasters to connect and either earn money for their podcast or advertise their brand. All you need to do is sign up to Podcorn for free and begin browsing the marketplace. The marketplace is easy to use and even has a handy calendar. One of the best things about Podcorn is that you have complete control over your spend as a brand or your price as a podcaster. You can charge whatever you want so you aren't constrained by the industry standard. Podcorn is an amazing way to connect podcasters to sponsorship opportunities, including host read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. So click the link in my show notes and sign up to Podcorn today. On the 17th of September, Stephen pleaded guilty to charges of threatening to kill, assault with driving with excess breath alcohol, which related to incidents in July and August.
On the 26th of July, he had threatened to kill a 16-year-old boy. He had entered the boy's home and tried to pull him outside. When the boy struggled, Stephen grabbed him around the throat and shoved him up against a door. The boy managed to free himself, but Stephen grabbed him again and threatened to kill him. But afterwards, he left and the boy called police. On the 9th of August, Stephen had been caught drunk driving. He did not plead on the charges of assaulting Coral's uncle, Terry. During the hearing, in which he was sentenced to 8 months in prison, Stephen's criminal history was revealed. Stretching back to 1991, Stephen had over 90 convictions, including 4 for threatening to kill, 4 for common assault, and 3 for assaulting a police officer. When handing down the 8-month sentence, Judge Dalmer said, "It was evident from Stephen's record and probation reports that he had numerous chances to rectify his evident issues with anger management, alcohol, and drugs, but he had failed to do so." As Stephen was led from the courthouse, he raised his middle finger and shouted obscenities to a group of people who had gathered outside. It was evident from Stephen's long list of offences and his behaviour that he was not a respectable man. But that didn't necessarily mean that he was involved in the disappearance of his stepdaughter. Gianna would finally break her silence to say that she believed, in her gut, that Stephen was not involved in the disappearance of her daughter. She said that he was a patient parent who loved both Coral and Storm like they were his own children, stating, "I could never fault him in his parenting of the kids. He has always been a good support to me, and he has had more patience with the kids than I have at times. He has never hit them. He's good to them." Speaking of Stephen's behaviour following the court hearing, she said that this was not the Stephen she knew, and said that he was just putting on a tough man act. Investigators would next appeal for new sightings of the white ladder, as well as information regarding any rubbish fires or burn-offs, particularly in any rural areas. Detective Inspector Drew announced the fresh sightings of a white ladder had moved them to focus on an area northwest of Greytown. It was now day 9 in the search for Coral, and other than her backpack, there had been no sign of her. The search had truly been hampered by the terrible weather. There had been torrential rain which turned fields and paddocks into marshes, and gale force winds that had even torn the roof off the search base in Featherston. It was then revealed that Carlene Rex, Coral's best friend, had been playing stones in the grounds of South Featherston School on the day that Coral disappeared. She said that she and Coral had been playing when the school bell rang. Carlene said that she headed into class, but said that Coral stayed outside by the gate. When she was asked if she knew what happened to Coral, she said no, but said that she really missed her best friend and really wanted to show her new Barbies. Thinking of Coral, Carlene said, "She was my best friend. She was pretty and she had interesting clothes." Carlene's statement only led to more speculation that Coral had been abducted from outside the school. Then on the 19th of September, the crushing update that everybody was dreading was finally announced. The Coral's body had been found. Her body had been recovered from scrub on the coast in an area near Lake Onoke. She had been found between toto bushes in farmland and had not been buried. The area looked as though it had previously been used as a hide by duck shooters. The area was cordoned off and Coral's body was guarded as a funeral director arrived on scene, shortly followed by an Anglican priest. At around 1:30 p.m, the priest said a prayer over Coral's body while a Maori constable, Stu Martindale, recited a karakia to bless the site. Coral was then taken by hearse to the medical examiner's office for a cause of death to be determined. If effort alone was enough to save Coral, then she would have been saved a million times over. The community had truly showed their compassion, with many people spending 18 hours a day searching for her. Following the announcement of Coral's body being found, it would be announced that Stephen had been charged with her murder. The investigators working on the case had played their cards very close to their chest. While it was the outcome that everybody had feared, the discovery meant that Coral's family could now begin to grieve in earnest. It had been a long and traumatizing 9 days searching for Coral, and at least now they knew where she was. Her family said, "We remember her as a bright and friendly child. She's loved by all of us and she'll always be remembered. Our plea to all New Zealanders out there is to treasure your children and help keep them safe." The following day, Stephen appeared in court. His demeanour this time varied substantially from his earlier court appearance. This time, he wasn't acting the tough man. As he was led into the courtroom, his face was flushed and he kept his head down. A crowd of people had gathered outside and they all hurled abuse at Stephen, as one man threw an egg which hit him in the face. Ron, who was seated in the courtroom, shouted, "Fry in hell, you piece of shit!" Stephen's defence lawyer, Bill Johnson, consented to him being kept in custody until his next scheduled appearance, which was set for the 17th of October. A memorial service was organised by Featherston Community Board member Adrian Staples and was attended by around 300 locals, including members of Coral's family. They sang a chorus of "Amazing Grace" and wore white ribbons as a symbol of sorrow, but also as a symbol to bring an end to violence against children in their community. Mayor John Reid shared condolences from mayors all across the region, while readings from Dr. Seuss and A.A. Milne were delivered by some of Coral's friends. Ron stood up to thank the crowd for all of their support, stating, "I felt like my family was the whole country. I want to thank everybody, not just here in Featherston, but around New Zealand." The memorial service truly gave the community a chance to mourn for the girl they had all come to love, even though most of them had never met her. The discovery closed one chapter of the case but opened up another one, the investigation into what happened to Coral and why. It would soon enough be revealed that investigators had actually been directed to Coral's body by Stephen. Coral's autopsy would show that she had been beaten to death. There was no evidence of a sexual assault. Following the autopsy, Coral's body was returned to her family so that they could make funeral arrangements. Another memorial service was held at St. Teresa's Catholic Church in Featherston. While it wasn't a funeral, it followed a very similar format and was simply a chance for the people of Featherston to say goodbye. Coral's funeral was held the following day in Matamata. Her loved ones spoke of a wonderful and beautiful little girl whose death must not be in vain. A number of family members read poems that they had written themselves, while others remembered good times with Coral, such as birthdays and Christmases. A Father's Day card from Coral to Ron was read out. It said, "I love you for building me a tree hut, letting me ride the tractor with you and helping me with my words. Love, Coral." Coral's yellow casket was sat at the front of the room. Beside it was a large yellow Tweety bird and a plethora of flowers which Ron handed out. Pastor Niels Jensen, who was Coral's cousin, said that the funeral was a special service for everybody to remember Coral. Following the service, Coral's casket was placed into the back of a hearse. Gianna kissed a rose and then placed it on top of the small casket. Ron walked around the mourners, shaking their hands and thanking them for coming to Coral's funeral and for their support over the past 2 weeks. A plot in the Matamata Cemetery was donated to Coral's family, just another spontaneous act of kindness shown in the face of adversity. A couple of days after Coral was laid to rest, the clothing that she had been wearing when she was murdered was finally found. A blue polar fleece top, red tracksuit pants and a bright pink jacket were found in bushes near Double Bridges. In October, it would be revealed that a couple of months before Coral was murdered, Ron had called Child, Youth and Family Services to say that he was worried about the safety of Coral and Storm. During the phone call, Ron broke down into tears as he told the operator how Coral was soiling herself and Storm was being overly aggressive. However, Child, Youth and Safety Services initially denied that Ron had ever called them, before admitting that somewhere along the way they had made a mistake and that the phone call had been placed and should have been formally lodged. Child executive Jackie Pivak said that she had contacted Auckland Queen Counsel Alyssa Duffy to hold an urgent investigation into how calls to the department are handled and whether similar calls had been dismissed as well. Child, Youth and Family Services came under intense criticism for how the phone call from Ron was treated. The investigation into the department would reveal systemic problems and failures and would recommend that the department's expectations, outcomes, roles and functions be clarified and that the demand for services be addressed. Their performance in care and protection were described as variable and quite often poor, as well as the understanding of how different parts of the department fitted together. It also found that the system was unbalanced and unstable, with workers focusing on investigation rather than casework and diverting resources. There was also an inadequate information system, which meant that there was no proper data regarding how many children were in the care of Child, Youth and Family Services. The investigation concluded by suggesting that the department focus on the safety and security of children, which is exactly the reason the department was set up in the first place. They would be given a multi-million dollar rescue package to ensure that the failing department could deal more efficiently with at-risk children. Some of the money would be used to hire more social workers. Ron said that he was happy with the fact that they were holding their hands up and admitting that they had done wrong. But he also said that if the inquiry failed to bring major improvements, then he would consider suing Child, Youth and Family Services. Coral's murder would truly reveal the dark underbelly of Featherston. It had become a centre of making methamphetamine, and people had been purchasing rural houses for next to nothing and then using them as manufacturing bases. As the year came to a close, Stephen appeared in court where he pleaded guilty to the murder of Coral. While he had initially denied any involvement in her murder, he would break down and confess during a videotaped interview. He said that he had spent the entire night smoking methamphetamine, and then at 7 a.m. he got Coral and Storm up to get ready for school. As they got ready, he made them their breakfast. He ushered the children into the backseat of the car, and en route to school they stopped at a service station where Stephen brought them a packet of crisps each. Outside South Featherston School, Storm got out of the car and went into school. Coral, however, said that she didn't want to get out of the car and that she didn't want to go to school. According to Stephen, he lost the plot when Coral was cheeky and unleashed a brutal attack on her. He said that he reached into the back of the car and grabbed Coral with his left hand and punched her with his right hand. He broke her jaw in two places so that it was protruding from her chin and knocked her unconscious. Coral suffered brain damage in the attack and was left bleeding heavily from the mouth. Stephen said that he then drove Coral around Featherston as she lay bleeding and unconscious on the floor of the back seat. He said he drove her to a bush on the edge of town to dump her, but when here he realised that Coral was still alive. When she made a noise, he grabbed a tree branch and hit Coral, fracturing her skull in two different places. He had said that he hit her with the tree branch because he didn't want her to suffer. According to the pathologist who had conducted Coral's autopsy, she was still alive when she was hit with the tree branch. Stephen then removed most of Coral's clothes and hid her body in the bush. After dumping Coral's body, Stephen then drove to the Rimutaka Ranges where he hid her clothing and then drove to a dairy farm where he tried unsuccessfully to purchase bleach to clean the car. He then walked to a petrol station and brought petrol to try and clean the bloodstains in the car. Afterwards, Stephen returned home. When he arrived, Gianna noticed that he was soaking from the torrential rain and smelled of petrol. He told her that everything was fine and he had been driving around looking for a job on a dairy farm. Gianna told Stephen to get a shower and she washed his clothing. After the shower, Stephen cut the carpet out of the rear footwells of the car, wiped the rear seat with a rag, and then set fire to two pieces of carpet. Later that same day, Stephen returned to Coral's body. He stuffed her into a stock feed sack and then put her in the trunk of his car. He drove her to the shore of Lake Onoke and threw her into a toto bush. Meanwhile, Gianna drove to the bus stop to pick Coral and Storm up from school, only to learn that Coral had never arrived. According to investigators on the case, they had suspected that Stephen was somehow involved very early on. Alarm bells sounded when Stephen was briefly interviewed within hours of Coral's disappearance. They felt as though his reaction was too managed. That same evening, Stephen had laid on the couch in the living room with a blanket over his head, ignoring friends and family who had come to offer support. When his mother, Robin Williams, tried to encourage him to join in the search for Coral, he replied with, "She's long gone, Mum. You know that. You know yourself that they can't last long in this weather." Just a couple of days later, Stephen was sectioned at Masterson Hospital under sedation after he attempted to smash his head through a window and kept saying that he wanted to die. Coral's family were all in court to hear the grim details of how Coral spent her last moments on Earth. Gianna kept her head and eyes to the ground as the summary of Stephen's confession was read out. The heartache on her face was evident. Outside of court, Coral's uncle, Carl, said that the guilty plea had brought a sense of relief for the family and said that they had hoped it would bring peace to them all. Ron said that he would be upset if Stephen received anything less than 17 years in prison. He said that when he was told that Stephen was using methamphetamine, he begged Gianna to throw him out of the house, warning her that it could end in tragedy. Stephen's mother, Robin, said that her son had been suicidal after murdering Coral and could not live with what he had done. She said that her own son's despair was something I hope I never witness again.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and their today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help. It's professional counseling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counseling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counseling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counselors specializing in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counselor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. Following Stephen's guilty plea, it would be revealed that Detective Don Finlayson had warned his colleagues before he quit his job as a criminal investigator in the months before Coral's murder that Stephen was a ticking time bomb, capable of murder. Stephen was very well known in the area as well as to police for his hefty criminal record and violence, and before Detective Finlayson quit, he had prepared a profile on Stephen so that his colleagues would know who they were dealing with. He said, He's well known around the area as a violent person. A loose cannon, basically. Stephen had spent much of his childhood in and out of foster care. While he had not seen his birth father since he was 2 years old, his birth father, Roger Stanley Williams, also had a violent temper, and in 1998 he was shot and killed by his partner in self-defence. Stephen had lived quite a transient life and had amassed almost 100 convictions since 1991. These convictions included burglary, theft, assault, drug dealing, drug use arson, unlawful possession of firearms, and threatening to kill. Despite the number of convictions, especially those involving violence and firearms, Stephen was only ever put away for a short time, and once released, the cycle would start once again. Local police had suspected that he was a key figure in the supply of methamphetamine, but they never had enough evidence for charges to stick. According to Detective Finlayson, Stephen didn't need to be on methamphetamine to be violent, stating, "He will nut off for any reason. Alcohol or whatever would help him in that respect, but he doesn't necessarily need it to fuel his violence." According to Detective Finlayson, on numerous occasions, police would fight their hardest to keep Stephen behind bars, but the judge would always grant him bail. A number of the crimes that Stephen had committed were while he was out on bail in the first place, or while other charges were still outstanding. He said that everybody was quick to blame Child, Youth and Family Services, but nobody wanted to criticise judges, adding that his failure to convince judges to keep people just like Stephen behind bars was what caused him to leave the police force. He said, "You try and help society, but when you keep getting kicked in the teeth by the judicial system, you don't feel there's any point anymore." The use of pure methamphetamine, known as P, was reaching epidemic heights in New Zealand, and six-year-old Coral had become another victim of the addictive drug. Over the preceding 2 years, seizures of methamphetamine had doubled. The demand for P had become even more popular than the demand for regular methamphetamine, and it was P that Stephen had been taking and had been addicted to. Drug treatment centres said that P users were more difficult to treat because the drug made them more volatile and anxious and could cause more aggression and paranoid behaviour. Dr. Roger Morgan stated that 60% of chronic users of P were likely to develop psychotic symptoms. Early the following year, Stephen Williams was sentenced to life in prison, with a minimum of 17 years.
The terrified and disbelieving look that must have been in Coral's eyes as you punched and hit her, the little hand that came up and tried to fend off the blows, will haunt you for the rest of your life.
The family was understandably devastated with the verdict. Outside of court, Ron screamed and shouted that Stephen would be a good guy if he were 6 feet deep. Some people who knew Ron said that he let himself down with this display of raw emotion. But Ron was unapologetic, stating, "I was really wild the other day at court, and I believe I have reason to be. I'm the only person in this country who isn't allowed to be wild about what he did to my daughter. If someone killed your daughter, how would you feel?" Following the murder of Coral, Storm moved in with Ron and his family and joined Pongakawa Primary School, where the principal said that he was a very happy, loving and caring child who was doing exceptionally well to cope with the trauma he had been exposed to. He remained haunted by what had happened to his sister, and Ron said that quite often, Storm screamed at night when he was asleep. A couple of months after Stephen was sentenced, he was moved to Parimaremo Maximum Security Prison because a number of threats had been made against his life and a $20,000 price tag had been placed on his head. In 2015, Storm spoke publicly about the murder of his sister. He said that his memories of his sister were fading and that he got her name tattooed on his right arm as a symbol that he will never forget her. He said that he likes to remember the good times with his little sister, such as how she loved to be cuddled and play with him on her push bike. He fondly recalled building mudslides with Coral and playing with their dog Magic on the front lawn. He said that he didn't like to dwell too much on what would have happened if he had stayed in the car with Coral that morning, or if he had urged her to come with him into school. He revealed that Coral hadn't actually wanted to skip school that morning, like Stephen had claimed. Instead, she had wanted to go back home to pick up the present she had left behind for Harold the giraffe, which was a visiting anti-drug mascot, scheduled to be in their school that morning. The family still celebrate Coral's birthday each year. They go to her grave in Mata Mata and clean her gravestone before surrounding it with fresh flowers and new ornaments. Ron said, "We don't get to spend that day with her, but we do in spirit anyway. There's not a day that goes by that we don't think about Coral. She's always part of our family and we miss her today like it was yesterday. She was my baby. I loved her and I miss her." That same year, Stephen was back in the headlines once again for trying to murder another inmate. He grabbed an inmate in a headlock and stabbed him repeatedly in the face and neck with a sharpened toothbrush. When he appeared in court, he said he was disappointed that he had failed to kill the inmate. His motivation was because he had wanted to be moved to another section of the prison and be segregated from the other inmates. He was handed another 5-year and 8-month sentence for grievous bodily harm. A couple of months later, Stephen once again tried to kill another inmate. This time, his victim was Nikki Roper, who murdered Alex Tvizi in 2010. Stephen gained his trust by inviting him to his cell to be tattooed. When Nikki returned for another round, Stephen attacked him with a light tube, stabbing him in the neck. Nikki attempted to get to the cell door to alert the guards, but Stephen grabbed him, choked him, stomped on his head, and then beat him with a broom handle. When the broom snapped, Stephen stabbed Nikki in the neck. Nikki survived the attack, and when Stephen was interviewed, he made it clear that he had hoped that Nikki would die. He told police that he would keep trying to kill somebody until he succeeded, stating that it was the only way they could keep him in prison until he died. According to some sources, Stephen felt so much guilt over what he had done to Coral that he wanted to ensure he'd never be released from prison. Justice Kit Toogood would subsequently sentence him to preventive detention for the attempted murder.
Stephen Roger Williams, you have pleaded guilty to one charge of attempted murder. Have you anything to say to this court as to why sentence should not be passed upon you according to law?
Matt, hurry up.
During the court hearing, it would be revealed that Stephen had been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. He said to a number of people that if he were ever released, he would end up killing again, so chose to attack fellow inmates to ensure that he never be released. Justice Kit Toogood stated, "In your interview with the probation officer, you took some delight in describing yourself as the smiling assassin, meaning that your future victims would not be aware of your intent to harm them until it happens. It is unsurprising that the writer of your pre-sentence report assesses you as presenting a very high risk of re-offending." Then in 2019, Stephen attacked another inmate by pouring boiling water and sugar over him and then stabbing him multiple times.
Coral's best friend, 6-year-old Kimberly Dittmer, a little girl coping bravely with her loss.
"Dear Jesus, I hope you find Coral soon and she is safe at home with her family and you find her today. Love, Kimberly."
And for ages I thought maybe she was just away and she'd come back. But then I watched her coffin go out and I remember saying, is that her in there? Is she in there? In that box?
And where is she?
She's somewhere with the angels.
From the moment it was noticed that Coral Burrows was missing, the entire nation became united, and in a way, became one big family, dedicated to assisting in any way possible in the hopes that Coral could be brought back home. Her death not only mobilised the nation, but sparked a change in the Child Protection Services of New Zealand. Coral's memory is still alive in Featherston, and in 2020, a memorial bench was unveiled at the spot where her body was dumped. It is adorned with a memorial plaque and overlooks the stunning vista of Lake Onoke. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big, massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Sasha, Kristen, Jerry, Jeremiah, and Lena. In return for your support on Patreon, you can get exclusive Morbidology merch, which includes t-shirts, stickers, pins, badges, fridge magnets, and car stickers. You can also get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, as well as bonus content from some episodes, and ad-free and early release episodes. You can also request a case for me to cover on the podcast. You can join Morbidology on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. There's no obligations and you can cancel any time. The support on Patreon seriously helps out. It helps to defray the costs of freedom of information requests, hosting, archive subscriptions, and much, much more. I'd also like to quickly mention that I've joined the app Stereo, and I'm doing live streams about true crime. Just click the link in my show notes, follow me, and you'll be able to join in on the live streams. It's completely audio-based, so don't worry about being on camera. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hi, I'm Jules from Riddle Me That True Crime.
I'm Robin Warder from The Trail Went Cold, and Jules and I want to tell you a little bit about a case that means a great deal to us, the death of 9-month-old baby Jacob Landine on April the 10th, 1987, in Socorro, New Mexico.
The day prior to his death, on April 9th, baby Jacob was being watched by his mother Brenda's new boyfriend John, not his real name, in his mobile home on 1453 Fatima Drive. While John was babysitting Jacob, Jacob would incur what would be his second head injury in a period of weeks. The prior head injury was a subdural hematoma or brain bleed, and it was serious enough that it needed to be lanced to take pressure off baby Jacob's brain while being monitored by doctors over the course of several days.
The circumstances surrounding how Jacob was injured and subsequently died are murky at best, with the suspect giving multiple versions of the events of the day, ranging from Jacob choking and accidentally hitting his head while trying to dislodge a cookie, to Jacob falling and John returning to see the injured infant.
The suspect also reportedly confessed to officers that he was indeed responsible, but there is no paper or audio record of this confession in the police file. The reasons given by the DA for not pursuing the case are confusing as well, with one of the reasons being that they were worried that John would file charges against the state.
It was the opinion of the doctors that baby Jacob was struck in the head and this was no accident. In the years to follow, John goes on to sexually abuse young Eric, as well as physically abusing his mother Brenda and emotionally abusing and isolating them both, making their world very small.
During the autopsy, layers of abuse seem to be present. A healing rib fracture from around the time of the first head injury is also discovered. It's impossible to say exactly when the injury took place, but what is clear is that someone was abusing young Jacob, and that person was most likely John.
Eric Landine, Jacob's brother, has been fighting to get justice for him. However, he faces some obstacles, such as the statute of limitations of 6 years on second-degree murder that State Representative Bill Rehm has petitioned to have overturned.
Join Robin and I, as well as criminologist Dr. Ashley Wellman, an investigative expert, a legal expert, a forensic psychiatrist, as well as Jacob's brother Eric, as we explore all angles of this case and try to bring awareness, understanding, and hopefully, ultimately, justice for Jacob.
The series starts on March the 1st. Tune in on your favorite podcast app.
Have you ever come across the concept of custom beauty? I know it sounds skeptical. It's like every time you scroll online, there's a new miracle product promising to fix your hair and skin woes.
But let me tell you, Prose is the real deal when it comes to custom beauty. It's not just some marketing gimmick. Your personalised formula wouldn't even exist without your input. Each product on Prose is whipped up just for you, tailored to your specific needs, and they go deep into their consultations, delving into over 80 factors to really get a handle on your life and beauty goals. We're talking about everything from your hair and skin concerns to what you eat, how much you work out, and even how stressed you are. My friend Jen has been using Prose and raving about it non-stop. They even asked her about her zip code to suss out things like water hardness and UV index. When I hit the States later this year, Prose is going to be at the top of my shopping list. But until then, I'm living vicariously through Jen's luscious locks and glowing skin. Trust me, this stuff is the real deal. Prose is so confident that you'll love your results that they're offering my listeners an exclusive trial offer so you can see the difference custom care can make. 50% off your first subscription order at prose.com/morbidology. That is prose.com/morbidology for your free consultation and 50% off your one-of-a-kind formula, prose.com/morbidology.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.